Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve is in conversation with Betsy Cooper, director of the Aspen Policy Academy at the Aspen Institute. As an expert in cyber and tech policy, Betsy shares her thoughts on how policymakers can keep pace with the rapid developments in AI and quantum technology, building a future-proof compliance strategy, and AI risks. Steve and Betsy also discuss policymaking in a volatile world, how businesses can protect their image after a breach, and what can be done to get governments to care about online scams.
So joining me on the podcast today is Betsy Cooper. Welcome, Betsy.
Thanks so much.
Now, Betsy's a leader who spends her life mending the gap between the people who write code and the people who write laws. As the director of the Aspen Tech Policy Hub and a former attorney at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Betsy's been at the forefront of every major digital shift of the last decade. And today, what we're going to discuss is why your AI strategy is a policy problem, how to defend your brand, and why the next great security hire might not be a coder, but a policy expert. I can hear people listening to this looking very quizzically at their screens because they know that I'm not a huge fan on policy. But I'm sure, Betsy, you're going to change me completely. Now, Betsy, I wanted to start with talking about some sort of futures and, of course, AI. With generative AI proliferating in the last few years, discussions about how policymakers can keep pace with technological advancements are becoming increasingly urgent, I'd suggest. But given the inherent slowness in good policymaking, how can today's lawmakers adapt to the pretty breakneck speed of AI or quantum development?
Yeah, so I think the first step is education. And that's something that I think policymakers across the board have struggled with is I think only very recently have we seen progress with technology being incorporated into the process of policymaking. There's great organizations, for instance, such as Tech Congress, that place technologists in Congress. That's a relatively new initiative. So I think policymakers need to spend some time understanding how does AI really work? What is expected to be possible today? What is expected to be possible a few years down the road? And make sure that they understand those capabilities. And by the way, that's on us as technologists as well to communicate it in an engaging and clear, transparent way that someone who doesn't do this for a living can understand. Then second, once you move beyond education, we really need systems that can respond more interactively as the technology changes. So you're absolutely right that a piece of legislation or a regulation often will take several years to come to fruition. And if that's the case all the time, then the technology will be far beyond that piece of regulation or legislation by the time it actually hits the books. So we need to create frameworks that people can interact with and change over time the nitty-gritty details. So this is a case where you don't want to include too much detail because that detail may get out of date. You instead want to set frameworks for policy that can adapt as the technology adapts so that we're able to stay ahead. This being said, a lot of the stuff that we have on the books now is from the 1980s or earlier, so anything would be better than sticking with the status quo.
I was going to say, listening to you there, you know, it sounds like you're talking about a revolution in the world of policymaking, because for a lot of people, the typical approach to it has always been that policy turns up a day late and a dollar short. What you're suggesting with the frameworks, I think, moves it, elevates it into an entirely different space, and is exactly what the industry needs, because it moves so very quickly. Is there evidence that policymakers are adopting that much more open, some might say, 21st century approach?
I think it's slow going because I think it's a new approach, as you suggested. I think it's a tweak to what exists. Legislators have always known that if you put too much detail in the law, then it becomes very hard to change over time. So that piece of it isn't new necessarily. But I do think that the speed at which things need to change is definitely a little bit different than what we've seen before. I think that at the state and local level is where a lot of the experimentation is happening today. At the federal level, very hard to get things done. But there are states that are really trying to be experimental in the way that they're approaching things. So, for instance, we've worked with the state of Utah to help them think about an AI framework, and a number of our fellows have helped successfully get that framework into policy in the state of Utah. There are cities that are doing really interesting things. There's a bunch of cities that have been convened around artificial intelligence questions and sharing those with each other. So I do think that there's innovation, but I think it's going to take time to trickle up. And so we should really see the state and local governments as the sandboxes in which these things get piloted. And then if they work well, then you're able to bring them up to the next level.
I wanted to ask you a question about state and local versus federal. In your opinion, is that the right way for us to be going about creating policy at state and local? Some would argue that the real approach needs to be at federal level, surely.
I think you have to be realistic, and the challenges at the federal level, the polarization, the challenges with getting things done are well known. And so I'm a pragmatist, and I would rather see experimentation happen than not at all. I do think that it would be preferable to have one coherent framework. I think industry would benefit from that if we did have that sort of framework. But also, I'm not sure that we're at the level of sophistication today that we'd be able to write the best framework because we haven't experimented enough. So I actually think that having the state and local sort of sandboxes, as we've talked about, leading to future federal policy is not a bad approach.
It's very interesting for me because obviously I travel around the world, spend a lot of time in Europe and also in North America, and I'm often finding myself comparing the approach of policymakers across the European Union, for instance, where one could say it is a sort of federal type approach to the approach that you're talking about here in the United States. And I think that there are benefits in both, to be honest. And I think if you're taking a much more sort of holistic view, then from an industry standpoint, as you've just mentioned, industry benefits because it knows where it stands. Life becomes a lot more simple in the way that you're starting to run your business across multiple jurisdictions. But also, you lose some of the nuance. So, the benefit for me of working much more at a local level is, as you say, you sort of put aside some of that, let's call it bureaucracy, for want of a better term. And so, you can actually get things done. I wanted to ask you if I was a CEO listening to this and I'm sitting thinking to myself, I really want to try to build a future-proof compliance strategy that's not going to be obsolete by the time the next major piece of legislation is passed. How might I go about doing it?
I don't think you can. So, unfortunately, I wouldn't be able to advise you to try to do that. What I do think you can have are smart frameworks for how you approach these things. So, first, at the beginning of your compliance strategy needs to be an understanding of your personal risk profile and how you're approaching these questions. So companies are very different across the board. Those that are working in national security industries or highly regulated spaces like food and drug, very different than a local painter. So you need to think about what is your particular risk situation and what are the key issues within compliance that you need to be most worried about. Then second, you need really smart plans, both to understand what the rules are today and how you're going to keep track of them so that if they change, you're aware. And AI is a wonderful tool for these sorts of things today. You can set up automated systems that will help keep you up to date on what's happening in different jurisdictions so you're not surprised if something changes. And then finally, you need to be prepared with an incident response plan that assumes that something is going to go wrong, and that incident could be a cybersecurity incident or it could be a compliance incident. Doesn't really matter. You need to have a response plan that you can put into place to be able to actually react and move yourself in the right direction. I think that one of the biggest challenges I've seen is when companies haven't really given thought to, what if I got it wrong? How am I going to respond? And so I think that's a real challenge. One of the things that seems to be most effective at that, by the way, is tabletop exercises. You know, I think CEOs are known to be more responsive and to not just want to pay off ransomware if they've actually gone through a tabletop experiencing what it might feel like to be under a ransomware attack. So the more that you can actually put your C-suite into real life scenarios where those decisions feel real and help them react, that will put you in a better situation if there's an actual incident you need to respond to.
I think good advice there, particularly around the tabletops, is nothing like actually rehearsing, practicing, so that come the day, you do actually know what you're going to be doing. And that does give, as you rightly point out, the CEO and other board members, for that matter, a degree of confidence that in a situation they wish they weren't in, they're going to know how to respond and they've tested it. Let me ask you, from policy perspective, Are there or what are the hidden risks of AI, perhaps say in algorithmic bias or automated decision making, that could really land a company in hot water before they even realize a breach has occurred?
A good one is if you try to use AI as your lawyer and assume that will be privileged material. We are taping this during the RSA conference, so I'm getting to see a lot of people out at the conference, and I've been hearing stories, for instance, of people who have just decided to plug a possible risk situation into ChatGPT and see what legal advice it'll produce. Guess
Okay.
what? That's not privileged. And so if somebody decides to try to discover those materials, you're going to have to disclose that, and then all that good work you've done with your lawyer is going to end up in trouble. So that'd be my first warning is ChatGPT is not privileged, so don't put anything in it that you don't want to be discoverable. I think also from a policy perspective, one of the challenges that companies may face is just not taking the time to actually understand the rules and how they affect you. So this is where your colleagues are incredibly helpful. I think that information sharing among companies with similar priorities is an incredibly helpful way to try to understand some of these nuances. It's when you try to go it alone that I think it can be more challenging because there's only so much that we all can understand. Most of us are not day-to-day policy experts, and so it's easy to miss something. So I think taking the time for that information sharing, really build relationships with other colleagues that are working in similar spaces, go spend time at conferences, networking and chatting about these things. That's really going to help bolster you so that you have the defenses if something does arise.
Very good. I want to look at geopolitics with you now for a moment. With the war in Iran and other conflicts across the world, the geopolitical situation is unstable and unpredictable, to say the least. How can nation states position themselves policy-wise, do you think, to protect their critical infrastructure from things like cyber attacks?
Yeah, I mean, these are tough times because there's so much incentive to use cyber for warfare purposes. And then the other bad guys, the ones that are just looking to make money, they're still operating. It's not like they've disappeared. I think the good news in some sense is that if you're doing a good job to start with, thinking about these cyber risks, this should be no surprise to you. There have always been nation-state actors that want to get access to sensitive data. If you have sensitive data on your books, you are probably a target long before these particular conflicts came to be. Even if you don't have sensitive data, you're probably still a target for ransomware purposes. So I
Yeah.
hope many of you who are listening are saying this is just business as usual. There's nothing that you can do particularly to prep for a cyber attack from Iran any differently than you would prepare for any other nation state attack, right? So hopefully you're ahead of the game. But if you're not ahead of the game, then this is a really important moment to start thinking about sort of the risk evaluation and the planning for incident response so that you can put yourself in a position to respond if something does happen. So long story short, the cyber attack profile is not as relevant to the companies. That's something the intelligence community should be thinking about. But like day to day, you get hit, you're probably not going to care who's hitting you. What you're going to care is how do you respond quickly? And so if you put yourself in a good position to respond, period, if you know who you're going to call, if you know what lawyers, if you know what contractors you're going to reach out to, if you have an incident response plan, that's going to put you in a good position no matter what type of attack appears.
Yeah, now would be a good time to be testing those things, right?
Exactly. Get your tabletop on next week.
Cybersecurity isn't just about that huge breach. It's also about data theft. It's about hacking the narrative, reputational damage, brand integrity. Those are things that increasingly we're starting to hear people being worried about. How should a chief information security officer work to defend against deepfake-driven disinformation that, say, targets a company's stock price or indeed reputation, do you think?
Yeah, if I had the answer to that, I'd be a multi-billionaire. I think first, this is where the risk evaluation really comes into play because you need to understand what are the specific things that somebody might come after you for. So if you're a sort of company that is focused in the food and drug business, then maybe your biggest risk is that somebody comes out and says that your product is unsafe or it's spoiled or something like that. You know, there's no one size fits all. You need to understand what your risk profile is to that sort of disinformation? And what is the worst thing that somebody could say that would affect your stock price or the way that your company is operating? So that's first. And that, by the way, is a great thing to do at like your annual convenings. You can do a brainstorming exercise among your employees to think about what those sorts of things would be. So you're not stuck as the CISO trying to answer those questions on your own. This is really where getting people who understand your company in and out can help you think about what those risks would be. Then the real challenge is disinformation can spread rampantly and it's very hard to combat. Having a marketing strategy for how you'll get ahead of that is really important. So, do you have a reporter on speed dial that something is coming out that's false you want to try to reach out to? Does your marketing team have a plan for where this might live on different platforms and how to try to combat that? So, again, it's a very difficult thing to try to prove a negative, and that's why disinformation can be so powerful. But it's also a very fast-moving space. So the faster you can get in there with your counter-narrative, the more likely you are to be successful.
Some really good advice there. Can we drill it down even further, though? Because very often we'd stay talking at the sort of the nation state level. We drop down to the business level, the industry, and we've got people that we can call upon there, right? Legal counsel, experts within our enterprise. And sometimes we often forget that actually companies are made up of people and people are also hacked. What can they do at the individual level? Because everybody today is a potential target, right? If you're doing something interesting, somebody's going to be interested.
Yeah, and that's really where we work today. So I run an organization that's now called the Aspen Policy Academy. The Tech Policy Hub is a part of our work. And at the Policy Academy, we teach people to learn how to advocate for change. And in the cybersecurity space, we specifically focus on people who have been scammed. So our theory of change is that right now, most people, if they get scammed, freak out, try to recover their funds, and don't do much more. And that's one reason why policymakers aren't very focused on it. It's one reason why it makes it easier for the bad guys to get away with it. So, as a community of people who care about these issues, as individuals who probably have experienced a scam or know someone who have, I had a nanny who was scammed out of their social security number and sensitive data. I've had family members who have given thousands of dollars to Best Buy that wasn't really Best Buy, right? We've all been there. So we need to be the ones who stand up and tell our governments that this is an important issue and that we need them to take action, both to protect their systems so that our data doesn't get lost and to enforce against the bad guys so that we're able to actually see a decrease in these situations. So we run things called Scam Fighters Workshops. So you can check them out on our website. And these are free opportunities for you to come in and get some basic ideas for. If you've been scammed or have friends and family who have been, what are the sorts of things you should be asking of your government in order to try to change that? And then we also give free coaching to people who have projects. So if you have an idea for a project you want to work on in your community, if you've noticed that your local garbage company is not using two-factor authentication, or if you have seen ransomware shut down your city and you want them to actually build better systems to protect against that, we can actually provide free coaching to help you move that forward. So this is all a partnership with Craig Newmark Philanthropies and their Take Nine initiative, which really encourages people to pause, take nine before clicking. And we're working on the piece that says, if you actually clicked or something went wrong, here's how you advocate for change so that hopefully others don't go through that situation.
So some really good assets, ideas, just a place that people can go and pick up some great ideas, even if they haven't been scammed, right? Because we're trying to prevent
Exactly.
people from falling into that. I like that Take Nine approach. Let's go back to policy now. So the world industry, the markets all globally intertwined. Something that happens in the Middle East affects everybody across Europe and the United States and further beyond. We all know that. But tech policy globally is still a bit of a patchwork. Different nations, different jurisdictions taking different stances. And the burden on industry, particularly for multinationals, is ever increasing. And different views, I think the frustrating element is how to regulate the tech industry. Well-documented spats between US-based companies and the European Union. There's always something going on there. What's your perspective? Should countries and blocs work to develop more unified tech regulations, do you think?
So, I think it's a question of the governance structures we've chosen for ourselves, and essentially that there isn't great enforceable international law. And this is not unique to cybersecurity. I used to work in immigration, and we certainly don't have a coherent framework for immigration law across countries, for instance. So I think the real challenge is that in order to enact more global or even regional tech policy, you would need an agreement among countries to really take seriously international or at least regional law. And that's proved very hard to get off the ground for reasons of state sovereignty and the fact that countries don't agree on everything all at once. If you're a company, I think that it would be a lovely thing to aspire to have more coherence. But in most cases, that's probably not realistic unless the jurisdictions, like in Europe, already have deep collaboration on the other side. So I think instead, your question should be, how can we work with the different jurisdictions as they exist to try to get them to independently align as much as possible so there's less variation that you have to deal with? So long story short, I'm not sure that a global tech or cyber policy compact is coming to a governance structure near you anytime soon. But I do think we could do more to nudge people in the direction of not having such different requirements that are all trying to achieve the same thing.
Indeed. And indeed, you've advocated for tech policy as a distinct discipline within organizations in particular. You've highlighted there some of the reasons why perhaps somebody might want to move down that road. But what are some of the benefits that you think a major enterprise could have by consolidating its effort into such a disciplinary area?
Getting them to focus more on tech policy as an advocacy strategy, or
Yeah.
so I guess it really depends on your company's goals. I would never advise every company to hire a government affairs person to advocate on tech policy. Again, if you're the painting company that is relatively offline, that may not be the right approach. Where you want to get involved in tech policy is if the regulations particularly affect your business model. A lot of times that's going to be because you're collecting PII, you're protecting privately held information. It's really sensitive. So that's a situation where you might want to be involved in the advocacy process on the regulations related to privacy. So I don't think there's a one size fit all where every company should be jumping into tech policy. I think, again, it's an evaluation of I'm really deep in privacy, or I'm in a highly regulated industry, or a particular regulation that's being discussed will matter deeply to me. And that's a time when you want to choose to elevate your voice. Then there are going to be some organizations, I think the AI companies themselves, for whom tech policy is so deeply intertwined in their business model that they need to be at the cutting edge of that. And then they're going to be the ones that are most deeply involved. But each company is going to have to make its own decisions as to where it falls on the in those categories and how much effort they want to invest in those conversations.
I'm glad you mentioned PII because I was going to ask you, as tech becomes what I would say is much more invasive, what do you think the new social contract is going to be between a company and its customers regarding data? So are we moving perhaps to a future where data privacy is a sort of a luxury, or is it a fundamental human right?
It's a good question. I think it's probably going to be a luxury, and it might not even be that. So, just to give you a concrete example, I'm the mother of a 5-year-old, and in order to get my 5-year-old's baseball schedule, I have to download an app on my phone. There is no web access for the app that has the baseball schedule. So, in order to get that baseball schedule, I have to sign away a whole bunch of privacy just to get my kid to a sports game. I think that shouldn't be allowed. I think that there should be a web option that does not require you to give these permissions to your phone. But that's a world we've moved towards, is that if you want a product, you have to give the data over for it. And I think that's really challenging. There's not, again, when you think about ordinary people adding their voices to these conversations, there's not been a groundswell of people saying, hey, I don't want to download another app on my phone. But maybe there should be more of a conversation around that, because that's the slippery slope in which essentially you've reached a moment where you can't get access to basic information unless you're willing to make that data trade. And especially in the case I'm talking about, where the data involves a 5-year-old, I really feel like we should have more choices. So I don't think that this is the end result that has to happen, but I think it is the end result that will happen if more people don't stand up and start saying, especially as an individual in the community, rather than as somebody who is deep within a company, that they care about these issues and that we should make different choices.
I think that's a really good example as well, Betsy, of how policy, if you like, isn't just something that operates at the highest of levels. It affects, in this example here, even a baseball schedule
Right.
and kids out there enjoying themselves. And that's something that affects all of us. So, Betsy, thank you so much for sharing some of those insights on policy. I must say, I have learned quite a lot about how people are adopting different policies. And indeed, I think the most interesting thing is about how it can affect the individual. And I think that is hugely important because, as you say, there is a degree of power that still exists with the end user. And if people are perhaps a little bit put off by downloading yet another app, then maybe we should start saying something about it rather than just accepting it and pushing back a little bit. So thank you so much for sharing some of those insights. And I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISEF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.